Finding Our Way is proudly supported by Berghaus. For a long time, Berghaus Kit has helped people access and enjoy outdoor experiences, and we are delighted to have them as partners for this podcast, sharing inspiration and expertise so we can all do our bit to improve diversity and inclusion in climbing, walking and mountaineering. Just a heads up, this episode involves a conversation about chronic illness, managing a diagnosis and treatment. For more detailed information, have a look at the episode description.
Hello, and welcome to the new podcast from the British Mountaineering Council, or the BMC, Finding Our Way. I'm Cress Allwood.
And I'm Marianne O'Hotter. This podcast is about diversifying the voices we normally hear talking about the outdoors. So in each episode, we'll be chatting to someone who's usually busy climbing, mountaineering or walking, and grill them to find out what they love, what they hate, celebrate their stories and insights.
These are the people making real change happen, representing underrepresented groups, calling out inequalities, and generally making the world a better place. We're going to get deep into the discussion and hassle them for practical advice.
So who's on today, Cress?
Today, an award-winning outdoors photographer and filmmaker who seems drawn to tell stories about climbers that are always about a lot more than just climbing. He's documented paraclimbers on the Eiger, climbing with autism and the mental health challenges and healing that climbing can offer. He also suffers from Crohn's disease, a painful and sometimes debilitating inflammatory bowel condition. So perhaps some of the insight in his powerful films comes from a very personal space. Connecting with us from Glasgow, welcome Ewan Ryan. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello, how are you doing?
Thanks for joining us on Finding Our Way.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So Ewan, let's start with how did you get into climbing and how did you get into filmmaking?
So I've been climbing since the age of 8. I started at a birthday party at an indoor climbing wall. It was one of these, it was the trend that year to go indoor climbing. Every year there's go-karting or paintball or something like that. But climbing was the trend that year for my school's birthday parties. So I went climbing and me and another friend really took to it, just enjoyed it, enjoyed this sort of different challenges that climbing can pose even to a beginner. So that kind of sparked an interest for me and my friend. We joined the kids club at the time, started going every Saturday morning to the indoor climbing wall, and from there progressed into outdoor climbing, a little bit of competition climbing as well. Learned to trad climb at the age of 11, and then like I say, like climbing for me has just become a bit of a life direction, you know. filmmaking. I guess I always enjoyed taking photographs and making short clips and things when I was out climbing with friends. And I was never too bothered about being in them myself, much to my mum's displeasure. She was always asking, where's the photos of you? I don't want to see photos of other people. I want to see you doing it. I basically realized that I quite liked just documenting things, documenting the adventures that I went on with my friends, or the adventures that my other friends, you know, were taking part in. And that kind of, when I left school, and this ties a little bit into my condition, but I left school with a bit of a, didn't really have a direction. And I had a year basically out after leaving school where I sort of floated about and wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do. I worked in an outdoor shop for a while. And then I kind of thought about how much I like taking photographs and making films for myself and thought, well, why don't you, you know, point yourself towards that? So I enrolled in a college course to do with television and film production. And the obvious thing then from that was to start making more serious climbing films, like trying to actually, you know, I watched a lot of climbing films, so trying to emulate them and trying to, you know, pick out my own style and pick out stories that I wanted to make films about. And yeah, I guess that, you know, the rest, as they say, is history.
Amazing. You make it sound so sort of poetic and perfectly aligned. I'm sure there were bumps in the road along the way.
Yeah, I before I enrolled at film and TV, I was about to go to Fort William to do like instruction work, like adventure tourism, I think was the course. So that was almost where my career went down the sort of ML, MIA and MIC kind of thing.
I have to say, I'm so pleased you didn't, Ewan, because I think your films are some of the most interesting climbing films I've watched. I'm not a climber, and often when I'm watching climbing films, I kind of, I'm sure it makes a lot of sense if you are a climber and you're into climbing and it's all about the particular route or you know how difficult something is. But otherwise, when you're not in the club and you're not versed in the specifics of what that person's doing or the technicality or the exposure that it represents, unless you see the shot, it kind of, they all become a bit samey, except your films aren't, because they're about the people who are climbing as much as about the climb.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What draws you to a particular story or climber?
I'm always interested in, the people that do climbing, if that makes sense, because climbing is such a strange sport. I mean, there's lots of strange sports. There's lots of weird hobbies that people have, but climbing is this one where you, for the most part, climbing a route up a rock face or a hill to an arbitrary point, sometimes not even the summit, you know, and it's just there are easier ways to do it. If the end goal is to get to the top, then what you're doing is completely nonsensical. Do you know what I mean? The amount of times I've been climbing and there's been some local youths gone by and go, "Hey, mister, there's an easy bit around the side," you know, and you go, "Yeah, I guess it is absolutely bizarre what I'm doing." So I suppose I'm drawn towards finding out why people do it. And I know that the reason I do it is probably just personal challenge, and it's quite a mindful exercise when you go climbing. You're pushing not just your physical but your mental, capabilities. And that's why I enjoy it. But trying to figure out why some people take that to the next level, like putting themselves in real danger, or perhaps trying to gain something out of climbing that I'd never thought about, things like the mental health challenges that some people face and how climbing's helped them with things like that. That kind of what draws me, like Marianne said a minute ago, I think there's definitely a huge place in the market for the classic climbing film. The sort of found the hard thing, tried to climb it, it was too hard, went away, trained, came back, it was still too hard, went away, did some soul searching, then came and climbed the hard thing, the kind of classic hero's journey. And for a long time, that's what climbing films were. Chris Sharma with his shirt off climbing some really hard stuff in Spain, and that's really cool. And there's still a piece of me when I see a film like this come up at a film festival which goes, yeah, like I just want to see Chris Sharma with his top off climbing cool things in Spain. It's just, you can really geek out about all these cool routes and you're like, man, that just looks so impossibly hard. And as a climber who's passionately into the sport, you can appreciate the effort and things that go into it. Perhaps, however, though, if you were a layman or someone not as interested in climbing, it all just seems a bit samey, like you said. And I'd never really wanted to make films that were just based, just solely for climbers. I wanted them to be viewable for everyone. You could show it to your gran and she'd have something interesting to say at the end, rather than just, "Oh, it's another climbing film you're showing me that I, blinked and missed the whole thing."
Yeah, that takes it to a much broader audience, doesn't it? So whether or not the audience is going to climb or not, there, as you say, there will be something about their personal stories that resonates with many people.
Well, climbing's kind of reached the mainstream in the past sort of couple of years with films like Dawn Wall and Free Solo that, reached international cinema audiences. And those, Free Solo, for example, winning an Oscar, like that doesn't happen with just a climbing film. That happens when you manage to make the challenge, the task that a climber is facing, like Alex Honnold, when you manage to sort of dig into their psyche and the character behind it, then other people can relate. Of course, there's an element of going, "Oh, that's scary what he's doing, and I'm terrified of, imagine being able to do that." But also just imagine the kind of person who's able to do that. And I think these films have been so successful because they've looked really deeply into the psyche of the person that does these things, if that makes sense, you know? Like Alex Honnold just appears to have no fear whatsoever. That's an interesting story for a lot of folk, even if you're not a climber.
That was my take home from watching Free Solo. Yeah. Just there's something funny with that guy's brain. One of the films you've made recently, Ewan, is We Need to Talk About Kev, about a climber called Kev Shields. Tell us a bit about that and Kev's story and why you made the film.
So I first met Kev through the dry tooling scene in Scotland. Kev is quite instrumental in the Scottish tooling series. And I just sort of crossed paths a couple of times through that sort of thing. And then just conversations, and I kind of found out a little bit about him. If anyone doesn't know who Kev is, Kev's a Scottish professional climber. He lives up in the Highlands, but he's from just sort of south of Glasgow in Ayrshire. He has a physical impairment to his left hand. So he used to climb ice climbing with a prosthesis, so an ice axe that sort of strapped to his hand. His right hand is perfectly functioning, but his left hand obviously was not. He also didn't just do that, but he climbed rock climbing. So with his left hand impairment, he would climb some really, really impressively difficult trad routes for a perfectly able-bodied climber. And really excelling at that. He also battles with epilepsy. So he had epilepsy for a long time, and he still has it, but it's medicated. But that affected his mental health and things like that. He then had an ice climbing accident in 2010, where he fell from an ice pillar in Fort William and shattered his ankle. And that kind of, you know, added to the list of things that were working against him, you know. And the ankle never really repaired properly. He had multiple surgeries on it to have various pins placed and then removed, and then all these different things happened to him. I kind of met Kev when he had already had his ice climbing accident, but he was sort of in between surgeries. And already for me, I thought, well, there's a story here. You know, this guy clearly has overcome a lot of adversity to be able to become a professional climber, considering the disability to his hand, but then also the level at which he climbs at is interesting anyway. He climbs quite bold trad climbing, so that kind of is an interesting personality anyway, someone who climbs things like that. And then add to that, he is just a great guy. He's just a really good character. He's a lovely guy to talk to, genuine stand-up lovely guy. And he just makes a brilliant interview. He's really open and honest. When you first meet Kev, you could perhaps come across as a kind of quite sort of typical Scottish male. But he is very interesting, and he's open and honest, and he's really, you know, willing to tell you how it is and how he's feeling in interviews. And that, as a filmmaker, is a total godsend, because then you get that personal story that you're looking for. With regards to the film, we decided that we'd just start filming some stuff. We'd film a few climbs, his recovery from his ankle injury, and try and sort of document that. But if you haven't seen the film, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but it was a three-year project, because things went on, and the end resulting film was not even the film I started off to make. You know, it was one of these ones where you start off making one thing, and then so many things happened at the end of it, you have a completely different film, and in my opinion, a better film, you know.
Does that happen a lot, Ewan?
In my opinion, what makes a good film is something that has become organic. So when you start filming something because you know that there is something here, but you maybe don't quite know what it is yet. I think if you try and script a documentary or a climbing film too much, obviously there needs to be some kind of direction you're going in, but there's one of my favorite documentaries is a documentary called Icarus on I think it was on Netflix, but it was about doping scandals in cycling and professional sport. And again, I won't spoil it for anyone, but that's one of these documentaries where they clearly started out to make a documentary about one thing, and then it just shot off in this crazy tangent. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it's worth a watch, because it's mind-blowing the amount of depth that the documentary went into in the end, where I don't think it started off like that. And that's, I think, perhaps where a lot of filmmakers miss a trick, is trying to script something or trying to really shoehorn a person or a character into the story that they want to tell, rather than letting their character tell them the story.
I guess it must require quite a lot of courage as a filmmaker to give your character or the story that space to kind of grow. Because if you start a project 3 years later, you're like, oh, hang on, turns out it isn't the story that I was hoping to tell. And it might not be.
I bet, I don't know personally, but I bet there are a number of filmmakers out there who have hard drives full of footage that they never did anything with because that did happen, you know? But, I mean, you're never going to find out until you try, right?
Mm.
Being totally honest, but halfway through making, when you talk about Kev, I wasn't entirely sure how I was going to edit it. I was like, I don't really know what the story is here. Like, this has been such a... Kev's life took, over those 3 years, took so many twists and turns that I didn't even know how to tell this story anymore. I still thought it was worth doing and it was good and it was interesting. Otherwise I wouldn't have kept going, you know. He was still the same person. He still had this amazing story to tell. But it was... As a filmmaker, trying to think about how then to relay that story to an audience, you know, I was like, you know, I had my head in my hands looking at, I re-edited it about three times. I was trying to edit as I went so that I was trying to have some kind of basis of an edit to come into rather than just starting from afresh with 3 years of footage. And then I basically started from scratch again anyway, because it took so many turns. And then the final twist in Kev's tale just threw me completely out the window, and I basically deleted my project file and started from scratch.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Yeah.
But worth it in the end, Ewan.
Oh, definitely. I'm really proud of that film because I feel like I did Kev justice, and that's something that's really important, I think, for me and for any filmmaker, is that you feel that your subject, you did them a service by making the film, you know. And at the end of the day, I'm quite good friends with Kev now. You know, we've got young children the same age. We've been on climbing trips together and things, and it would feel pretty awkward, I think, to make a film about someone that you actually quite like, of going to like as a friend, and you don't like the film or they don't like the film. You know, I was very nervous showing Kev the film for the first time. I didn't know what he would think of it, but luckily he liked it.
Yeah, brilliant. You said that Kev, you know, kind of might be perceived as your traditional Scottish male, but he is forthcoming about mental health battles and how climbing has affected him and helped him. Do you think there is a change? Is there a change that you're perceiving in those traditional sort of male communities or people feeling more able to speak out about good and bad mental health?
I think, yeah. I mean, the real subject over the last year in particular with lockdown has been mental health, because this has been a trying time for the entire nation's mental health. I think men traditionally don't obviously have as open a conversation about their mental health with their peers, and there's definitely not as much as they should. But I feel like it is improving. There's a long way to go. There's a long, long way to go. I wouldn't say there's... I wouldn't say we're anywhere near the finish line there, but someone like Kev breaking down that stereotype of the typical Scottish male and being open and honest is really refreshing, because someone like Kev, who has been through so many issues with his mental health and also just times in his life that have been very challenging to him, and to come out the other side as the person he is and able to talk about it is really, there's few and far between. There's not a lot of folk out there who can withstand so many, you know, barrages and still come out the other side smiling and willing to talk to you about it.
And express those emotions so eloquently as well, in a way that you as an audience member can totally relate to. But that's, I guess, your talent as a filmmaker as well.
Well, I mean, it's much easier to edit an interview with someone who talks eloquently and expresses themselves well, than someone that you have to, you know, try and draw stuff from. That's again, that's probably why I like this film so much, is because I like Kev. He's a really good guy.
He's got a lot to say.
He does, yeah. And he's got a very good way of saying it, a very unique way of saying it. And other than his accent, he has such a his turns of phrases that comes out from time to time are just absolute gold.
And when you're filming someone on a route, obviously you can't be on necessarily on the same route, or you know, you need to be at the side somewhere. So how do you recce the site and work out where to be and rig it so you're safe? Can you tell us about that?
A lot of it is experience as being a climber yourself. I think trying to become a filmmaker or make a film about a climber and not being a climber yourself always produces subpar content. I've definitely watched pieces on TV about climbing or climbers who've clearly been filmed by just a bog standard film crew, and from an adventure filmmaker's perspective, just rubbish, you know. being a climber, you understand the route, you understand where they're going, you perhaps can converse with the climber beforehand, you know, where is the crux, where's the difficult parts that you want me, that I really want to film, where are you likely to fall off if you're thinking this is a, you know, maybe a fall off situation, or what bits do you really want me out the way for, things like that. So gaining a lot of information about the route before you even, you know, start any kind of filming is really helpful. And there are so many different types of climbing. Filming so many different types of climbing can be so different as well. For example, sport climbing.
Yeah,
for sure. You've generally got an equipped route. So you've got bolts, and perhaps if it's a popular cliff, there's multiple lines to choose from. I did a project with Steve McClure in Spain a few years back, where I was able to equip a fixed rope up in an adjacent route, and then use lanyards and clips to pull myself into his route, and then release myself as he came towards me and move up the route with him, more or less.
Oh, wow, okay.
Or I could say to him, you know, where are you going to rest? Where are you going to stop and shake out on your route?
Yeah.
And he could tell me where. Then I knew that was the time I could quickly sling the camera around my shoulder and go up my ropes to the next section, you know. And it's a full body workout. I remember being absolutely knackered at the end of that week. But we got some great footage out of it. But that's sport climbing. That's really easy. But trad climbing, you know, climbing a route that doesn't have equipment, you're talking about abseiling, you know, getting to the top of a route beforehand and rigging up a belay and, you know, abseiling down routes and then jumarring back up the ropes. And then, you know, the next step up from that is like the Eiger, where how do you recce the Eiger without climbing it? Well, when I did two projects on the Eiger in the space of a summer. And the first one was on the west flank with paraclimbers. Myself and my partner, who were going to be filming, we went and climbed about three quarters of the route about a week beforehand, just as a recce, just to see what the route was like, to see the angles and that kind of thing. We were lucky that obviously we were quite able-bodied, so we could, able-bodied fit mountaineers, we knew that we could go up and recce it quite quickly. And that meant that we, for the next week when we were climbing with the paraclimbers, we had a bit of inside knowledge there. But filming on the north face of the Eiger with Robbie Phillips and Willis Morris was a whole different kettle of fish, because it's suddenly a route that's too hard for me to climb, you know. So like, what do I do in that situation? Luckily, and I honestly couldn't have been more lucky, there were two alpinists. They had been working another route on the face at the same time, and they had fixed ropes positioned on the cliff face, all the way from the Stolenloch window. You know, on the north face of the Eiger has a train access window, and pretty much from there to, you know, most of the way up their route, they had fixed ropes in place. And they just happened to run perfectly adjacent to the route that I was filming. And so after kind words and talking to them, they agreed that I could use the ropes to gain access to film. Robbie's climbing this route, Paciencia, and I am just to the left on this new route, Odyssey, which was, you know, I could never have gotten to that situation without an entire team of rigging people and that kind of thing. You know, I literally was there up. It was myself, Robbie, and his partner Willis belaying him. You know, there's no other crew or anything like that. So, like I say, being a climber and a mountaineer certainly helps when it comes to reccing and setting up and keeping yourself safe and in check. And at the end of the day, on that route in particular, I filmed about three pitches more from there, and then I bailed because it got too scary. The north face of the Eiger is a horrible place to be. It really is. It's raining rocks. This is in the summer as well. So the ice in the top of the mountains melting and releasing rocks. And so it's raining rocks the size of fridges, you know, and a brick-sized rock scuffed past me and clipped my camera and things, and I just kind of went, yeah, I'm done with this now. gave them some GoPros, and then abseiled back down to the train tunnel and got a train down to town and got a beer.
Oh, that sounds like the good bit of the day. But that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, in your experience, you not only, you know, take on routes and mountaineering for yourself, but also you've watched people really pushing the boundaries, and you know, you're right there in their faces, in their heads. Why do people do that? Why would you want to climb a route where something the size of a fridge might end it all in an instant?
I mean, what's the old quote from Hillary? Why climb Everest? Because it's there. I don't know. I think a lot of climbers, it is such a personal thing. And like I say, so many people have different reasons for doing it. And I guess it's the same with most climbers. Why does anyone put themselves in a dangerous situation like, you know, hard trad climbing? Because it feels amazing when you do it. Like personally, when I've completed a hard trad climb that's been near my limit, you get this amazing rush. When do you ever get to push yourself like that in life, really? Stepping onto the top of a climb when you've completed something and pushed yourself and tried hard and perhaps even risked, you know, injury or worse. The exhilaration you get from the end of that, like any other adrenaline sport, is really quite something. So there's definitely an adrenaline aspect to it. But again, why do people go hill walking? You know, a lot of people would rather sit at home and watch the TV of a weekend. Some people are happy not to leave the house on a sunny day. Why does anyone go and walk up a hill to the top and down again? It's just as nonsensical and pointless as going trad climbing or sport climbing to other folk.
That is, to be fair, exactly what my husband says. But you just got to walk back down again. So why are you doing it? And there might not be a view at the top. I mean, like, genuinely, why are you doing it? Yeah. It's like, because why not?
And at the end of the day, you feel like you've achieved something. No, I mean, that is the age-old question. Why do climbers do it? Someone much wiser than me, I'm sure, can give you a fuller answer.
If we're going to talk about Crohn's disease, for those of us who don't know, what is it and how do you manage it? Tell us about how it affects your life and your climbing.
Okay, so if anyone doesn't know, Crohn's disease is in a group of diseases called inflammatory bowel diseases. So it's different from things like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Inflammatory bowel disease is an immune problem. So it's a bit, in most basic terms, your body thinks that your intestines are an infection and they're trying to fight it. So it's in that class of diseases where you've not done anything wrong. Your body is just malfunctioning. There's a wire's been crossed somewhere. When I was about 14 or 15 at school, I was always quite a skinny lad, but I started to lose weight quite quickly, and I felt the urgent need to go to the toilet a lot. And as a teenage boy at school, it's really an unpleasant thing to have to do. I don't know if you ever set foot in a boy's toilets in a secondary school, but it's not a nice place to be for any length of time. And that kind of, I got progressively more ill, and there wasn't really an explanation. But it was quite a gradual process. It happened over maybe about 6 or 7 months. And I lost so much weight that eventually I couldn't walk to school. I was begging my mum for lifts to school, and she said, yeah, young fit teenager, you're not getting a lift, you know, on you go. Because it was about a 2 mile walk or something to school up a big hill. Basically, my school was on the top of a big hill, and I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't walk, I couldn't concentrate in classes, I was falling asleep in classes, and everyone just thought I was just being this lazy teenager. But eventually I got so bad, I had stomach cramps, I was curled on the sofa in tears most nights, and that bad. That I went to the doctor, and my parents say this, that when they saw me in the context of a hospital, they realised how stark the problem and the change had been in me. Seeing me in a hospital bed, they realised I was skeletal. I looked like I had an eating disorder or something, you know. But because it had been so gradual, they hadn't really noticed, or they hadn't really fully appreciated the extent of it. So I was really quite ill, and I was in hospital for a while on steroids and things like that to try and gain me some weight and to try and sort of figure out what was wrong. So eventually I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease after a few unpleasant procedures like colonoscopies and MRI scans and things like that. And essentially, I felt like a bit of a death sentence at the time as a 16-year-old. It's like you've got this thing, you've got Crohn's disease. It won't go away. We can't give you medicine that'll make it disappear. But we can give you medicine that can help control it and can help you to live with it. And it floored me. And I left school. I dropped out of school. My first opportunity. I had a bit of a, teenage crisis. Suddenly I was just like, what's the point in doing anything? So I dropped out of school. And that's when I decided, well, I got fitter again. When I was ill, I couldn't climb. I stopped climbing and I couldn't walk up hills and things like that. But when I got a diagnosis and started to become a bit more fitter, that's when I decided that I was going to grab this by the horns and I was going to become a mountaineering instructor. And I was going to move up to the Highlands and never see any of my friends ever again.
And was that to kind of, like, two fingers up to the disease, prove that you can do anything regardless?
It was a knee-jerk reaction. It was. Because at the time it felt like, I either roll over and don't do anything and let this thing, you know, take over my life, or I decide that I'm going to have to deal with this or at least learn to live with it. And I think a lot of people around me at the time did see the change in me, where I decided that I was going to deal with this. I was going to get a handle on it. And I started to gain weight again. I started to get medicated, medicine, various different medicines, and some were more effective than others. And eventually, we found a course of medication that worked for me, that kept my disease at a base level, in remission more or less. If I watched what I ate, and I watched, you know, how tired I got, things like that, fatigue can be a big problem, then I could probably carry on doing the things that I loved without really any problems. And that was the light at the end of the tunnel for me, was realizing that as soon as you get something like this under control, it doesn't have to be a death sentence.
I imagine that some of the specialists or doctors that you were talking to, when they're saying, okay, if you're careful about what you eat, if you make sure you don't get too tired, you know, you take care of yourself, then you can live a decent quality of life with this. It doesn't need to take over. I'm imagining that they're not in their forefront of their minds imagining you then on the north face of the Eiger, because I mean, surely those kind of big mountaineering journeys, that adventure filmmaking, some of the stuff that I do, the bottom line is that you don't know quite when you're going to eat. It's difficult to know what you're going to eat. It's exhausting. You have to pull long days. I mean, how do you manage those two demands?
I'm very lucky that my Crohn's disease is controlled and managed by my medication. There are some people who really struggle to get any kind of management from their medication or from lifestyle changes. The people that have to go through surgery to have, you know, sections of bowel removed, sections that have gotten too strictured, so they become scar tissue and they, you know, just have to remove sections of intestine. People that end up with stoma bags and things like that, colostomy bags and that kind of thing. These are really the kind of the real dark places of Crohn's. Crohn's can start to, you know, really just destroy your quality of life. However, I know people with stoma bags who say that it was the best thing that ever happened to them because it gave them a quality of life back. And like me, the diagnosis that I got was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I could then start to understand what was wrong, and I was lucky that my medication works, and I could get back to a point where I almost didn't feel ill anymore. And I don't feel ill. I mean, I've been a couple of climbing trips with you, Mary. Would you have guessed looking at me that I had any kind of chronic condition?
No, absolutely not. No, and it's only when we were standing in a Sainsbury's on the way up to the Isle of Skye that you said, "Oh, there's certain things that I need to buy," and I was like, "Oh, right, okay." Kind of thinking, "Oh, fussy eater," but then, So, how do you manage it on an expedition? What are the things that you can or can't do that you do or do need to be careful about?
On expeditions or climbing trips, you tend to be eating when you can, or perhaps eating foreign food or shopping in different supermarkets and things like that. And you can't rely on the things that you're used to eating or that won't make you ill. It's a bit of a minefield. I have had times where I've been on climbing trips and I've eaten the wrong thing and I've just had to lay up for a day or just take it easy, and or I've had an upset stomach. Managing it is just a case of taking my medication at the correct times and not doing anything foolish. Eating a massive curry the day before I'm meant to go up a hill, you know. I find that for me personally, anything that upsets my stomach tends to be the kind of thing that upset most people's stomachs. You know, big rich meals, lots of dairy, spicy foods, things like that. They tend to affect me tenfold on the average person. But if I'm sensible, you know, I should get away with most meals, you know. And like I say, my medication it's powerful stuff. The kind of medication I'm on is the kind of stuff they give to transplant patients to stop their body rejecting their organs. The side effects list is, you know, about this long, you know, the possible side effects. And it really quite makes for a scary reading, but it is effective. I take oral medication and I also self-inject medication, and it keeps my disease at a level where, like I say, I don't feel ill anymore. And that I can only be eternally grateful to the NHS and to my consultant and the nurses and doctors who have helped me over the years to get to that stage, because, like I say, they gave me my life back. I could do these things I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
You're absolutely right, Ewan, that if you were walking down the street or having a chat with someone at the pub, no one would know. You know, that is the nature of hidden disability, isn't it? And if I saw you, you know, I'm standing in the queue for the loos and you're walking past me to nip to the accessible toilet, I hope that I wouldn't say anything, but I might give you a second look, kind of like, oh, is he allowed to use that loo?
It's about cultural perceptions and how many films and comedy programs have you watched where there's been a storyline of someone using a disabled toilet where they shouldn't have, and then this big horrible social situation has arisen from it. You know, there's this massive social taboo about using a disabled toilet if you're not disabled. Well, again, there are so many hidden disabilities or people that just perhaps need that extra space. How would you, from a lineup, be able to identify someone who has a colostomy bag or a stoma bag? You know, they could look like any one of us. Just because it's on the inside, it's on their stomach. How do you know that they don't need to go in to empty that or to change it, or they have an issue, they have a leak or something they need to sort? I like the campaign that Crohn's and Colitis UK ran to make not every disability is visible. Although there are obviously many others, like Crohn's disease and colitis are very much ones that you probably wouldn't guess that people had it. Personally, I try not to use disabled toilets unless I really need to. I will wait in a queue or I will use regular toilets 95% of the time if I feel that my going to the toilet is like 95% of the population. You know, if I've stopped at motorway services and I'm going to go for a wee, I'm going to go and use the regular men's toilets. I'm not going to go to a disabled toilet because that's abusing a privilege that sometimes I really do need. You know, and that's, I think, an important thing for myself to make me feel a little bit more normal sometimes. It's just exciting, but go and use a toilet like a normal person, you know. Whereas sometimes I stop at motorway services and I cannot wait. I don't have the time to wait. It's not because I've pushed it too long. I waited to the next services. You know, it's not that kind of case. It's my body didn't give me notice. My body said, you need to go to the toilet right now. And short of pulling over in the hard shoulder, you know, this is a situation I need to go to the toilet right now. If there's a queue or if You know, if a disabled toilet is the only one available, I'm afraid I have to use it. I don't have the luxury of an average person of being able to, as an adult, being able to stand and wait to use a toilet. It's a sudden urge syndrome, I think, is the term given to it. But it's a side effect of Crohn's and colitis, and even IBS sufferers can have it as well. You don't get this opportunity to wait.
I believe there are over 300,000 people in the UK alone that have inflammatory bowel diseases, should we say, but we still seem to be really poor at talking about them. You know, how do we break down these stigmas from talking about things that are to do with, you know, that area of the body and, you know...
Well, we can't even say it. Poo. Talking about...
It's about the people with young kids. you know, talking about poo has become a daily occurrence for me now, you know, especially with a two-year-old trying to potty train them.
But it's different in adults, isn't it? You know, we can talk about it, okay, and with kids it's somehow acceptable, but, you know, as we become older, it's like, oh, not sure about that.
There's no need to dwell on it, but there's also a need to be... there's a need to be frank about it when it's appropriate. Like for example, a medical condition where... You know, someone can't deal with it. I think for me, getting diagnosed took a bit of time because I was embarrassed as a teenage boy. I had to hand in stool samples and get colonoscopies and things like that, and I put them off as long as I could because they were just embarrassing. You know, as a teenage boy, telling your friends, "Oh, why are you going off today? I'm going to go to the hospital, and they're going to put a camera on my bum." How could any teenage boy look at you with a straight face and say, "Okay, that's fair enough"? You know. Of course you're going to get jokes and laughs and things like that. And that was a horrible kind of experience for me, was trying to find a core group of friends who understood the real situations going on here that I could confide in.
Do you think that was part of the reason that you got so ill before you ended up getting medical help, that on some level you knew something was wrong, but it was about your bum?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Especially, I mean, I'm sure it's just as embarrassing for a teenage girl, but as a teenage boy, you're going through so many difficult periods in your life there, you know. Everything about your body is hormonal and changing at a rate of knots, and you can't keep track of it. And add to that something as embarrassing as a toilet problem. You just thought, oh, kill me now, really, you know. I remember at school they gave me a key to the disabled toilet, and I was like, how embarrassing is it now to, you know, in front of people go and use a disabled toilet? What's wrong with you? How come you get to use your disabled toilet? You know, there's no winning. And I think the way we overcome that is starting at a young age in the early years and talking about disability or talking about people with other, you know, needs and that sort of thing, that it just slowly becomes not as big a horrible issue. I think everyone's going to always struggle to talk to each other about their bowel movements, but it's because it's not a particularly pleasant topic. Well, for example, think of a food substance that you absolutely hate that will make you vomit instantly. You know, people universally have the same reaction if you start talking about poo. Everyone kind of goes, oh, because everyone poos and everyone knows what it is and what it smells like, and that instantly it garners up that kind of repulse kind of reflex in everyone. And unfortunately, if you end up in a situation where you need help because you're not pooing like everyone else, then I'm afraid it's a very difficult situation to deal with. And like I said earlier, finding a core group of either friends or family or a person, a partner that you can confide in is a huge, huge, you know, help and benefit. My wife knows my needs, you know, ins and outs. Whenever we're out and I go, I need to go to the toilet, she goes, no problem, we'll go and find the toilet. There's no question. There's no why. What's wrong? You know, it's you go. And the same with my climbing partners. Most people I go climbing with just know. If I scoot off into the bushes all of a sudden, no one's panicking that I've run away. You know, they just wait a few minutes, I'll reappear and we carry on with our day.
You and I imagine that particularly, I guess, young people who are grappling with diagnoses like the one that you had, thinking, oh, this is the end of everything I thought I was, everything I'd hoped to do, will hear your story and take great strength and comfort from it. What would your advice be to someone who's dealing with a kind of diagnosis of a chronic condition?
First of all, as a diagnosis, is congratulations, because I know how hard it is before you're diagnosed with anything. The amount of time that you spend in and out of hospitals and just being unsure in yourself about what's wrong with you, that is really, really, I think, probably the most tough time. Being diagnosed is also exceptionally difficult and very hard, but you should view that as the starting step to perhaps not recovery, if it's a chronic illness, but dealing with it or getting a handle on getting your life back. There are obviously so many chronic illnesses out there, and I am a very lucky person where my chronic illness is dealt with and medicated correctly, and I can lead a normal life. And I really sympathize with folk who don't have that luxury, or other people with Crohn's disease who are still battling with it. And that's, I don't know if I can offer a whole lot of advice to that, other than you have to keep battling, and you have to make sure that, you know, medical professionals know exactly how you feel, that you're honest with people, you're honest with yourself more than anything. You know, when days when you're not feeling well, just take a day off, just relax, you know, let your, even just it's your mental batteries, but just recharge a little bit. Because I know from personal experience that trying to do too much for any kind of condition is just, it's not good for you. And dealing with like a chronic illness and exhaustion is just like, it's, you know, they don't meld very well, you know.
You have a young daughter now. Has being a dad changed your attitude to climbing, changed your attitude to risk?
I have never been a particularly risk-led person. I mean, I'm perhaps less risk-averse than the average person walking down the street. But I have a very acute sense of when I feel safe. If I'm dangling in a harness on the north face of the Eiger, but my harness is well secured and I'm attached to the rock face and there's no rocks falling on my head, I feel safe. I could be 10 foot off the ground. I could be 1,000 foot off the ground. It makes no difference to me. Being in a dangerous situation where I know that there is real risk to my health right now, I don't like that. And I think becoming a parent hasn't changed my outlook on that, with regards to climbing. I still climb trad climbing. I still do a lot of sport climbing. Sport climbing doesn't feel particularly risky to me, a lot less risky than getting in a car. And trad climbing, I think within my ability and with, you know, understand, I've been trad climbing for so long that I'd like to think that I know where my limits are. And obviously accidents happen, but like I say, driving a car, accidents happen, you know. So if you live your life avoiding any kind of risk, you're not setting a very good example to your kids then, are you? And the only thing I gave up when I had a child was speed flying, like paragliding kind of thing, because I didn't feel as in control. I used to fly like miniature paragliders, speed fly things, and I sold my equipment when I found out that my wife was pregnant, because that was one of these sports that I felt I could possibly get into a lot more. And it was a lot more risky than climbing.
Wow.
Not justifiable anyway.
Yeah.
Amazing. Sure. Ewan, thank you so much. You've given us so much to think about there. And listeners, I would urge you to hunt down Ewan's films. A lot of them are online on Vimeo. Is that the place to go to see them?
Yeah. Vimeo page, and BMC YouTube has a few films of mine as well on it. I've produced a few films from the BMC as well,
including one with me, climbing up the inaccessible pinnacle.
Including
it's one of Ewan's films about someone climbing who is not a good climber, but does get to the top and down safely. So, you know, I've given it away there.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Come on, the jeopardy.
Oh, I know. We were all wondering. Cress, should we finish with our quick fire questions?
Okay. So, Ewan, we have 10 questions that we ask every guest on Finding Our Way. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Quick fire questions.
Describe yourself in 3 words.
Ambitious, creative, and inspired. Like I take inspiration in a lot of places. So I feel inspired by a lot of things.
Favourite mountain or crag snack?
Crag snack. Ooh, I'm very, very partial to a pork pie.
Best mountain memory?
Ooh, probably topping out the Eiger with the paraclimbers. A wholly overwhelming emotional experience for the situation and the achievement.
Bucket list destination?
I would love to visit the Himalayas.
How often do you get lost?
Every trip. I have absolutely no sense of direction. I was stood in the middle of Chamonix pointing in the wrong direction, saying that that was Mont Blanc. And my friend I was with righted me and said, "That's Mont Blanc." Took about 10 paces and then pointed again at the wrong mountain and said, "Is that Mont Blanc?" Like,
Ewan, are you funny?
Funny, ha-ha, funny or peculiar?
Either. I think that's our answer.
I've embraced my dad jokes.
If you were an animal, what animal would you be?
I would probably have to be a red deer. Oh, nice. I love, it's one of my favourite things about going to the Highlands is seeing the deer just galloping through the moorlands and things like that. It really is a great, you know, sight to see, and I quite fancy just having that ability to make good progress through marshland at a seemingly unbelievable pace.
One thing you always carry on the hill?
I always have a camera of some kind, if it's a little point and shoot or if it's my big DSLR. I always have something on me because I can't let a photo or a view go uncaptured.
What does climbing mean to you?
Climbing means community, I guess. I met my wife through a sort of mutual love of climbing. My best man at my wedding is my longest climbing partner. Some of my closest friends and the biggest life experiences I've ever had have been with people that, you know, I met through climbing, and it is such a great community for that alone. You know.
All right, last question, Ewan. We want more of you. Where do we go?
Okay, so I'm on Facebook. I've got Final Crux Films Facebook. I also have an Instagram page. I have a Twitter, although I don't use it so much because I'm confused by it. I don't have any witty political opinions to make, so I don't think Twitter's exactly for me. And like you said earlier, I have a Vimeo page where most of, in fact, all of my full-length films are there to watch for free.
So on Vimeo, Final Crux Films, BMC TV, yep, on YouTube, and what's your Instagram handle?
Final Crux Films, no complications, that's it.
There you go. Thank you so much, yeah, Ewan. It has been absolutely brilliant talking to you.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. It's been good to delve into these things.
Great. And thank you for listening to this episode of Finding Our Way. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode, share the podcast with friends, and also, really importantly, let us know what you think. Use @teambmc on Instagram and Twitter, and use the hashtag Finding Our Way.
We'll see you for the next one.
Bye.
Finding Our Way is brought to you by the British Mountaineering Council and is proudly supported by Berghouse. It's produced and presented by Cress Allwood and me, Marianne O'Hotter. It's edited by Chris Stone, and the artwork was designed by Neil Arch. Follow us on your podcast app so you don't miss an episode, and join the conversation on social with the hashtag Finding Our Way.